The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay, folks. It's good to practice with you. So, the late Wes Nisker said there are firsters and thirders. And by that, he meant that some teachers talk all about the first noble truth. Some talk all about the third, you know, that the cessation of suffering. And I regret to inform you that your substitute teacher is indeed a firster. But I think that the first noble truth, in some sense, contains the other three, too. That if we open our heart to dukkha, the dead end of clinging is illuminated. We sense, even if very dimly, the possibility of a kind of radical freedom, and we intuit some path of carefulness moving us in the direction of more freedom. The Buddha says, comprehend dukkha, you know, suffering, comprehend it. But to comprehend dukkha requires us to move against the stream. That's what I was alluding to in the guided instructions. We ask our thinking to do so much, and it does not enough, but so much. And to comprehend dukkha means we actually must stop fighting it, at least momentarily. And that is very, very counterintuitive for some part of our system. It's a major project to open to our own suffering, but sometimes the suffering of the other is even more evocative for us, right? Maybe the lack of resolution in our own heart with our own suffering makes the suffering of the other even more evocative. Sometimes the suffering of the other person, the other people, is evocative in a way that opens us to compassion. But sometimes our care gets tangled up with fear or control or some strand of our own clinging. And what would it be to comprehend the dukkha in another's life? When we have entrusted our heart to another by choice or birth, it means that all of their suffering feels like our business. All of it is somehow directly relevant for the project of my life, but it often does not mobilize compassion. I don't know quite why, but do know as a child, you know, the suffering of a parent or caretaker has huge implications for the child's safety. It's not a cause for compassion for the child. The pain of a parent is destabilizing for the child. The pain is a kind of existential threat. It means that the world is not governed by their will. And the suffering of a loved one is sometimes experienced still as a threat, even as we're all grown up. I feel like that's persisted in me. There's some childlike panic even in the face of very modest suffering in a loved one. And it strikes me that so much of our, pain and squabbling and all of that can arise from our unconscious relationship with the pain of the other, that deep wobble that can happen when we see a loved one in pain or we see a loved one acting out their defilements, greed, hate, and delusion. And just as goodness can resonate with goodness, that's the sphere of Dharma, is goodness resonating with goodness. Suffering resonates like bells with suffering. Neurosis resonates with neurosis. Their pain evokes my fear or control. Researchers have done brain imaging studies, like of one person while seeing a loved one, suffer with a pain task, so they're sort of like in the scanner, but actually witnessing the another's, a loved one suffering, and a lot of the brain lights up regions associated with understanding the inner state of the other, theory of mind, with emotional resonance, and some of the same things that would light up if we were in pain. And seeing suffering in our own life gets us scrambling to reorder circumstances, and seeing suffering in the life of the other, same. And in order to reorder circumstances, it is often to reorder them, who they are, and compassion devolves into the impulse to change them, to force their growth. And the intolerance of suffering masquerades as compassion. But it is, in fact, our fear, our aversion, our worry, our judgment driving and distorting our behavior. And all of that controlling for all of our efforts never works. Compassion is not the insistence that suffering dissolve. That's just the grandiosity of ego, the insistence that my love, my care make suffering dissolve. Compassion is not the insistence that suffering dissolve. It is simply love in the face of suffering. And if your intervention in the other's life includes force, it will be experienced as alienating. If your love is not infused with understanding, it will be experienced as alienating. Love, in other words, is by definition attuned. Otherwise, it's some cheap replica of love. The here, I'm, and I'm like talking tough here, like as if I can do this, but I cannot. It's, there's a path. The divine abodes of compassion and equanimity work in balance. And if there isn't a seed of equanimity in our heart, our compassion will get entangled or impatient or coercive in some subtle way. There's the equanimity side, which is something like love in the face of helplessness. I do not govern this. Can my heart still maintain some measure of openness? I cannot rescue you from this suffering. I desperately want to, but I cannot. And compassion is not an insistence that someone change. It is deep, open-hearted acceptance, love in the face of suffering. Yeah, we wish to help, but there's an acceptance that's striated through true compassion. And sometimes it's equanimity that must purify our compassion. We forgive their conditioning, forgive their conditioning. We need a lot of forgiveness. They do too. Not to condone harmfulness or pretend that we have no needs or something, but to forgive at a deep level. And what this really means is to understand their inner life. Not to understand it from the vantage point of your needs, how you perceive their defilements. The other person is not a planet orbiting you, the sun. We orbit each other. And that entails that we have a mature relationship with ambivalence to tolerate the mixed experience that is loving anything, that is being alive, you know? Psychoanalyst Adam Phillips says we're ambivalent about anything and everything that matters to us. Indeed, ambivalence is the way we recognize that someone or something has become significant to us. Ambivalence often the way I think about the First Noble Truth, that things are not just one way. Pleasure trembles, others heal us and disappoint us. The moment does not satiate. Can we open our heart to ambivalence? And opening to some ambivalence entails a measure of grief, some loss that things are not just one way. We're never just one way, will not be just one way. So we have to relinquish the kind of young fantasies of an interpersonal life devoid of ambivalence. Our love has to become wiser, more patient, to accept the limits of our control, to reorder the inner life of another, to the extent that it will their they that their life will be reordered. It will be a function of our love and patience, not an insistence that they change. Thich Nhat Hanh, if you pour a handful of salt into a cup of water, the water becomes undrinkable. But if you pour salt into a river, people can continue to draw the water to cook, wash, and drink. The river is immense and has the capacity to receive, embrace, and transform. When our hearts are small, our understanding and compassion are limited, and we suffer, we can't accept or tolerate others and their shortcomings. We demand they change. But when our hearts expand, the same things don't make us suffer anymore. We have a lot, of understanding and compassion and can embrace others. We accept others as they are, and they have a chance to transform. Understanding someone's suffering is the best gift you can give another person. Understanding is love's other name. Understanding is love's other name. So, please track this. today, to the extent you're interested, track the impact of the pain of the others on your heart, what it mobilizes in you, the love it mobilizes, the control it mobilizes, the aversion it mobilizes, what happens in that cauldron of the mind when people we depend on suffer. I wish you all good day. See you tomorrow.